18-1984, Emrachem Holdings v. Volkswagen Group. Mr. Bradford, please proceed.
May it please the Court, I'm Michael Bradford up here on behalf of Emrachem Holdings. And there are two basic issues here on appeal. The first being that the 558 patent should have been removed as prior art in view of the Campbell Declaration. Now, inventor declarations can be used in numerous ways in patent cases. And one of those is to overcome a presumption against the declarant. So, example, if you're overcoming a presumption of validity, the declaration must meet a clear and convincing standard. Now, other times, a declaration must only overcome a prima facie case to make a prima facie case evaporate. And in those cases, the declaration is only required to raise a question of material fact. And the board, in its decision, used an incorrect legal standard in relying on the Woodland and Sant cases. In those cases, required a clear and convincing evidence standard. Now, here, Emrachem only had to overcome a prima facie showing that the 558 patent was prior art. Therefore, Emrachem only had to put forward evidence sufficient to raise a question of fact that Campbell and Guth invented the subject matter cited in the 558 patent.
What case is the best authority for you that an inventor can swear away a prior patent by a bare assertion through a declaration that he was the inventor of the relevant passages of that prior patent?
Well, as far as the most factually analogous, there are several patent office decisions. Ex parte Morishita, ex parte Aba.
Okay, let's put those to the side.
Sure. And so really, the two CCPA cases at issue are Katz and De Bon. Mm-hmm. And if you look at De Bon, for one, it states that an unequivocal declaration by itself, or unequivocal declaration is sufficient to remove a reference as prior art.
Well, and we could debate that. Is there a quote that you have that says that? An unequivocal bare assertion by the inventor that he is the inventor of passages 1, 5, 7, and 9 of the prior art patent is his and his own, and so therefore it's not by another?
Well, it doesn't say a bare assertion is sufficient, but it also doesn't say the corroboration is necessary.
Well, it talks about it's an evidence-based inquiry, and based on the record in that case, the CCPA was satisfied, right?
And if you look at the record in that case, the De Bon Declaration, it's shown in the case. It says in paragraph A, I submitted... paragraph A says the drawing shows a device.
Attached here to is an exhibit, which is a drawing 73-315.
Correct.
Right. So the inventor in De Bon attached a contemporaneous drawing from back in the day that Mr. De Bon had given to his patent attorney.
But there's also nothing that suggests he created this drawing. Really, what he's saying, it's another way of showing this is what I conceived. For example, in a patent application, the specification can have words, and it can have a drawing.
Well, whatever it is, it's something in addition to the affidavit, the exhibit, right?
It is something. In addition to words, there's words in the drawing.
It's something.
It is something. Now, but the N. Ray Katz decision has a declaration only. And there's an important distinction between De Katz and De Bon. Now, in De Bon, they explain...
But then the declaration, you say declaration only, but in Katz, the declaration has something in it in addition to talking about what was invented. It talked about these other people who were on the article were just students or whatever.
Well,
so, I mean, there's something else other than the declaration insofar as it affected the declarant's inventive contribution.
But the DeBond case doesn't require explanation about the other inventors. And there's
a reason. I think what Judge Chen was pointing to is we have this case in which we have just the declaration that goes to the question of what part of the joint invention I invented. Nothing else, nothing. And I think what Judge Chen was pointing to was in DeBond, there is something else. We can argue about the significance of it. It's the exhibit with the drawing. And in Katz, there is something else, which is the inventor's view of what these other people, not inventors, but other people on the article. So there is something else, right?
Well,
don't you think it's fair to look at both of those cases as declaration plus cases as opposed to bare declaration cases?
Well, Your Honor, they're both simply declarations. And
no, I understand there is just a declaration, but the evidentiary record, because I believe that Judge Neese in both of those cases were pointing out this is essentially an evidentiary question, right?
Well, I don't recall what Judge Neese said about it being an evidentiary question. But the board relied on these cases for asserting that there must be documentary corroboration.
And must be something else. That the bare declaration wasn't enough. There must be something else.
Well,
they talked about, and corroboration is a term of art in a way, isn't it? That corroboration means something else to support what is said by the declarant.
Well, corroboration, though, is typically, when you think of corroboration, it's an independent showing. All DeBond did was take a drawing and said, I conceived this. Campbell, in the same way, is saying, with words, here's what I conceived. I don't see how that's a difference.
I think we're in a quagmire over here on this side of the bench. We're trying to draw a straight line through all of our case law, not only for this very specific narrow issue, but as a general matter with the inventorship doctrine. You understand the law of the inventorship doctrine, and you understand the Supreme Court has, at times in those very old cases, been quite skeptical of an inventor's bare assertion without more as being something that's reliable. And now we have to look at the scenario we have in front of us here and try to understand the best we can the meaning of the message through DeBond and Katz. And both of those talk about how it's an evidentiary-based exercise. They just do. And neither of the facts in those cases can fairly be characterized as just being a bare assertion by an inventor declaring without any details or any story that he was the one, the true inventor of the passages that he elects to cite as being his own. There was something more going on in each of those cases. It just can't be disputed. And so now we have to ask ourselves, okay, against the backdrop of inventorship law, which this is a very close cousin of, and the facts of DeBond and Katz, which in each situation, there was something to, borrow from Judge Clevenger, bare assertion plus. It wasn't just the bare assertion itself. And now we look at your case, and we have the inventor basically saying, me and my co-inventor invented all of these passages, not the other two co-inventors listed on that patent, and full stop, period, end of declaration.
But, Your Honor, the MPEP and the Patent Office in several cases has taken DeBond and Katz to mean that an unequivocal declaration by itself is sufficient in very similar circumstances.
Which era of the MPEP do you think controls this case? I mean, right now we have a current version of the MPEP that's, at least at a minimum an adjustment of what it was back in the 90s.
Well, Your Honor, here 103C was added in 1999. And in that situation, it removed any patent owned by the same entity has been removed as 102E prior art. So actually, If this application had been filed 24 years later, we wouldn't even be here on this issue. So I believe the Volkswagen and American both agreed in their briefs that they believe the mid-90s version of the MPEP would apply.
In any event, even if it did, the briefing on the other side presents a story of why the outcome here by the board is consistent with the MPEP, because what is going on here is not something that's disclosed but not claimed, but it's disclosed and claimed, which the MPEP, for whatever reason, is elected to, at least at one point in time, find a distinction on. So I think, you know, I don't know if the MPEP or any version of it necessarily helps you.
Well, Your Honor, the disclosed but not claimed, I kind of see it as a separate issue, but there, it's pretty clear if you look at the CFR and the cases that are talking about the disclosed but not claimed issue, that they're discussing an instance where there's a first patent that has one claimed invention. And then if that same claimed invention is then claimed in a second patent, that's an interference type of position.
I'm sorry, I've got another question. My understanding of the MPEP provisions were that the agency was trying to make a good faith attempt at interpreting Dabon and Katz. And do we give deference to the agency's interpretation of our own precedent?
I believe, unless it's contrary to precedent, they do. But this disclosed but not claimed issue is not discussed in Dabon and Katz.
So
believe that's...
you think the agency, we should give deference to the agency's reading of our own precedent?
Oh, no, you shouldn't give preference, no.
Right. So I guess what I'm saying is if we were to conclude that there's an interpretation of our own precedent by the PTO through the MPEP that is an incorrect reading of our own precedent, then that doesn't have any persuasive value at all.
Well, clearly the Federal Circuit would apply. But I do think it shows how other people have interpreted prior CCPA cases, so I think it's helpful to see. And the several patent office cases that have accepted Bayer declarations, I think that's helpful to see that's the understanding of what those cases mean. And it's also important, Dabon and Katz were in a situation of, as I understand it, those were situations in prosecution. And there was an examiner, and he didn't have any way to depose or to contradict the testimony at issue. And there's no presumption of validity. Now here, the patent is issued. There's presumption of validity. We're in a case where...
This is an IPR, right?
Correct.
I thought this IPR statute says there's no presumption of validity once the patent is brought back into an IPR. I could be wrong, but am I?
I could be wrong okay. on that issue. But there's definitely not any... there's not any presumption against AmeriChem. And if you look, the board didn't really rely on Dabon in saying there's a documentary corroboration requirement. What they relied on are this Woodland and Sant cases, and they used an eight-factor test in Woodland and Sant for determining to give no weight whatsoever to the Campbell Declaration. But those cases involved where a alleged infringer was trying to show prior use and invention to overcome, to invalidate a patent. So they had to overcome the presumption of validity. And in that case, you have to show clear and convincing evidence.
Can't you have a situation where someone's trying to swear behind a reference to say, I was earlier conceived and reduced to practice this invention?
That would be...
And if someone is making that trying to avoid a piece of prior art being cited against it, right?
Yes.
It could be a similar situation to what we have here. And the legal standard in that case would be what? Would it require corroboration, right? The person who's saying, I believe that I was the prior conception and a prior reduction of practice, and I wrote down my declaration saying why it's so, that declaration wouldn't be worth the paper it was written on without corroboration.
Well, but the conception reduction to practice...
I'm just saying, isn't that correct?
I don't know that they're the same issue because here we're...
No, I'm just saying, wouldn't you require corroboration in that setting? Of course you would.
Yeah, I mean, I believe.
Of course you would, right. So then, and this is, I think, the adversary's argument, why should it be different here?
Well, because here there's a shifting burden production.
No, forget about that. As a matter of interpreting the law, what we're doing here is trying to decide what by another means. How do you go about proving what by another means? And is it enough for one person's just declaration to say, it was mine, to mean it was not by another? So what my question is, why should the standard be different? The concerns relying on an inventor who has skin in the game, has a stake and whatnot, and maybe it was a long time ago, and they're saying there's similar concerns exist.
Well, but all of these cases involved inventors that have skin in the game.
Well, I understand that, but in all of the skin in the game case instances I can think of, we require corroboration.
Well, I mean, here, though, all Campbell's saying is he's presumed to be an inventor of the 558 patent. And
well,
he's saying...
In the joint patent, he's presumed to be the inventor of, well, of all, of whole, it's...
One claim.
Joint and several. He's presumed to be the inventor of everything or just only a piece.
Yeah, so is everyone else listed on the patent.
So is everybody else.
They're all presumed to only have invented something. There's not a presumption
right,
they invented everything.
It's hypothetically possible in the 558 case that your client invented stuff that's not in the suit. And it was somebody else, his co-inventor, invented all the things that are in this suit.
But he swore under an oath that he did invent everything in the suit, and there's nothing to contradict that.
He didn't swear that he didn't invent everything else that's in there. You could have joint inventors who all of them invent everything.
But he said solely. He said Campbell and Guth solely invented the subject matter. I mean, he swore under oath. There's nothing that challenges the veracity of his declaration. And this is, I've gone over.
You're in your rebuttal time. Why don't we hear from the other side?
Okay.
Ms. Lynch? Oh, no. Who's first? Mr. Lynch.
Steve Meyer for...
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. You're just listed in the wrong order on my sheet.
Okay.
But,
good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I am Stephen Meyer on behalf of Appellee Volkswagen. The Campbell 558 patent is prima facie prior art to the challenge 558 patent under Section 102E.
How do you get around DeBon and Katz?
I don't get around DeBon. Well, I get around Katz. DeBon is in our favor. In DeBon,
what was it that the CCPA, I mean, we're bound by DeBon and Katz, right? You agree
yes.
with this?
Yes.
What was it then in DeBon that you think is in your favor?
The court explained that the question of whether appellant is the sole inventor was properly raised by the PTO, and it was incumbent on appellant to provide satisfactory evidence in light of the total circumstances of the case that the reference reflected his work. And
what was it that the court held satisfied that requirement in DeBon?
It was the declaration itself, plus the drawing that was annexed to that affidavit, to the declaration
so
as an exhibit.
Do you have the DeBon case handy? Can you open it up, please?
Yes.
Okay, so the opinion begins, and then you see opinion Roman numeral 1 right after it. Tell me when you found where I am so we can follow along with each other.
Yes.
Okay, so number 1 is just general statements. Number 2 talks about the board. Number 3, Roman numeral 3, all on the same page. It's a very short opinion, luckily, is where we really see the discussion of both Katz in particular and what is sufficient to establish the sole inventorship. Following the word opinion, is there any place in the opinion itself that discusses the drawing that was attached? I'm going to help you out because there isn't. The word drawing doesn't actually appear, and nor is there a discussion about it. Instead, following where they discuss Katz, they talk about the affidavit and how in a different case, Fasius, The inventor didn't say in the affidavit he clearly both conceived and reduced to practice. And that, so the problem with that other affidavit wasn't a lack of corroborating evidence. It was a lack of a clear assertion in the affidavit itself, which is viewed as evidence. So nowhere in the opinion of the court do they reference the drawing. Have I missed anything to your knowledge?
Yes.
What have I missed?
The sentence that states, on the basis of the record here, which includes appellant's unequivocal declaration that he conceived anything, blah, blah, blah.
Right, but it doesn't mention the drawing, right? It just says, on the basis of the record here, which includes this declaration saying he sees it.
The record. So it's based on the record. Now, and the record.
Let's go back. Hold on. I understand your point. You're making a generalized statement. But let's go back a page. Why don't we look at footnote number 5? And why don't you read footnote number 5 out loud to us? I was surprised nobody cited it. Why don't you read footnote number 5 out loud?
We do not consider it necessary to include drawing number 73315. And as the board explained, the reason that it wasn't included, it wasn't necessary to reproduce the drawing in this opinion. Not that they're not considering it, it's what that was addressed in the board's decision in our case. They explained that the drawing was not included in this opinion, not that it wasn't included in the record.
So you don't, when you say we do not consider it necessary to include drawing number 73-315, help me out because I don't know the facts as well as you clearly do. Are you saying that that is a quotation from the board?
No, that is a quote from the court here, the CCPA, explaining that they didn't reproduce the drawing here. We is the CCPA.
That's what I thought too.
And
so when they say we don't find it necessary to include this drawing, I should interpret that as a conclusion by you that they didn't think it was necessary to solely reproduce it in the opinion, but it was nonetheless absolutely necessary to the outcome of the opinion, even though after the sentence it says we do not consider it necessary to include the drawing, they never mention the drawing again anywhere in the opinion or in any portion of the analysis that led them to conclude the affidavit was sufficient on its face. That's the interpretation you would have me give that sentence.
Yes, the drawing here,
it's never mentioned again after they say we don't need to include it.
The drawing that is shown in the case comes from the patent, and they say that it is the same. And then they have a footnote that says that they don't include it. It's not necessary.
And then in the entire portion of the analysis of why the affidavit was sufficient, they never mention the drawing. Never. Words don't appear. And yet I'm supposed to conclude that in the context of a PTO-based proceeding, where there is actually a presumption of inventorship that attaches based on assertions and declarations that are filed, that when an affidavit is included that articulates portions of things that were invented by one person or another, that's not enough. Even though in this case, it was clearly enough and this case never mentions the drawing anywhere.
It does mention the drawing, and it mentions
in
the
background
date of the
section
drawing.
Where it yes. says we don't need to include it.
Do we make anything of the fact that the opinion, in quoting the affidavit, has a description of what's in the drawing?
Yes, exactly.
Attached here to is an exhibit is a drawing which illustrates a velocity profile development of a yada yada and a yada. The drawing shows this, that, and the other thing, yada yada yada. So there is the opinion of the CCPA contains a description.
Yes, and that is consistent with what I said earlier and also what the board in our case explained. In the opinion, it says that the drawing wasn't included in the CCPA.
That's in the opinion we're reviewing?
The opinion that is on appeal, yes.
Yeah.
Just to be clear so I understand, the portion of the opinion that Judge Clevenger read isn't actually the opinion, is it? It is the quotation of the affidavit. Isn't that right? It's not the opinion. The CCPA didn't say that. They block quoted Mr. DeBond's affidavit and included it in the background section. I just want to make sure we're all on the same page so I'm not missing anything.
Yes.
Is that right? Okay. Now, you think DeBond helps you. Then tell me, what about Katz helps you?
Okay, before I address Katz, I would like to point out two other board decisions, the Ethicon case and ex parte Boris Rubinsky, where they reached the same conclusion about the bond, that the bond's drawing was the corroborating evidence.
Okay, in Katz, what was the corroborating evidence?
The corroborating evidence was the declaration explaining the work of the students as being authors.
But that's not corroborating evidence, that's just further assertions within the declaration, right? How is that corroborating evidence? It's just the declaration itself, and every one of those statements is an assertion by the author.
Yes, but there the difference is that it's not a patent, and the CCPA explained that distinction. In Katz, it was an article, and the authors are not presumed to be inventors of what is disclosed in there and is said to be anticipatory of the application at issue.
So are you saying, thus, because it's not a patent but rather a publication, corroboration is not required?
Higher, more corroboration is required when you have a patent and you're disputing the named inventorship on the issued patent.
Okay, so I just want to make sure I understand the rule of law that you're asking us to adopt. If it is a publication with multiple authors, a declaration alone with a good story in it by the author is sufficient on its face, can be sufficient on its face.
That is what Katz says.
That identical thing would, in your view, not be sufficient if we're talking about a patent, which is the prior art.
Correct, yes, because there is a presumption of inventorship attaching to the named inventors on the Campbell 558 patent. And, in fact,
another way of putting it is that Katz doesn't so clearly say the latter. I mean, Katz does say the co-authors may not be presumed to be co-inventors merely from the fact of co-authorship.
Yes.
And so what Katz is telling us is that, at least for articles, and when there are numerous listed co-authors, there shouldn't be a presumption that each co-author is an inventor of every little concept that's contained in the article.
Correct.
But Katz doesn't take the next step and say, what do we do when it's a series of listed co-inventors for a patent? There's an implication there that maybe with a patent is attached to certain legal rights, and when you have a bunch of listed co-inventors named on this legal right, that maybe there should be a presumption that the default is that they're all share rights in everything that's been invented, and because they were co-inventors of that.
Yes, in the Hess case, there is a presumption of inventorship attaching to the named inventors on a patent. And for consistency, I'd like to point out that this court requires corroboration of oral testimony for joining putative co-inventors under Section 256. Also for...
Just so you know, I don't think that's a bad rule of law, but I'm just wondering if I'm bound by certain earlier cases that establish a slightly different application in this unique context. And that's what I'm trying to figure out. I have no problem with corroboration as a necessary component and can see the value in it. So I understand why you're bringing those cases to our attention. It's just that those contexts are a little different from this one. And I'm bound by everything the CCPA did before. And those cases seem more on point to me than
you're
saying.
And I'm wondering if you even, to prevail here, do you even need a strong corroboration requirement for these arrangements where someone's trying to swear away from a reference by claiming that he was the sole inventor of the relevant passages of that prior reference? Because what happened in Katz and DeBon, at a minimum, were declarations that were filed that had at least some story attached to it.
Yes,
and
correct.
It wasn't more than it was more than just a conclusory assertion of being an inventor of certain relevant passages, at least. In DeBon, Mr. DeBon goes through the story of how he developed this drawing in the early 1970s and then submitted it to his patent attorney, and he describes that in the declaration in efforts to get a patent, the first patent, of which he was a co-inventor with someone else. And then so that's his jumping off point to claim that that relevant part of that earlier patent was really his and his alone. Same thing with Katz. You know, maybe we could debate whether this is a wise move of our precedent to say that a co-author can basically disclaim his co-authors from an article by saying they were just students. But apparently we said that was good enough. In any event, in both situations, there's a story contained in the declarations. In both cases, we have CCPA decisions saying, based on the evidentiary record in the case, these declarations were good enough.
Yes. And if you look at it from the sufficiency of the evidence standpoint, Judge McKelvey below assessed the evidence and found that it was insufficient. That's an evidentiary finding, and it is...
I'd like to ask you, we don't have much time left, to please turn to whether or not there was notice and comment, the Claim 3-16-20 issue on whether or not it was proper for the board to rely on the Stiles reference for the rejection, ultimately, of those three dependent claims.
Yes. Stiles was mentioned in our petition, this section.
Yes, I've read your petition, and I have it handy here. So when I look through your petition with regard to Stiles, it is mentioned in the abstract with regard to Claim 1. It is never mentioned with regard to Claims 3, 16, and 20. In fact, you provided a very helpful, I think I and certainly the Patent Office always find it helpful when people give us claim charts, because it helps us understand exactly what and what within what you're saying is pertinent. You provided a claim chart on page 54. Let's just start with Claim 3. You say that Claim 3 is obvious based on Campbell and Saito, and you actually tell me which portion of Saito you think discloses the carbon dioxide gas. So do you ever anywhere in your petition mention that Stiles is a reference that could be used to provide missing dependent element from Claim 3, for example?
We included it in the body. And
where? Because everything I found on it was with regard to Claim 1 only. So where did you include it for anything other than Claim 1?
Okay, on page appendix 114.
Yes, I'm there.
Claims 1 through 14 and 16 through 20 are obvious under section 103A over the combination of Campbell and either Hirota or Saito in view of Stiles.
Yes, that's a general statement. And then immediately after that, you have a very detailed claim chart that tells me, in particular, which of those four references apply to which of each individual claims.
I would point to the Quozo case, where it was claims 10, 14, and 17 were instituted, and claim 10, the claim chart, had no mention of Evans or Wendt, and claim 14 had the claim chart. The detailed claim chart had no mention of Wendt.
But that was different because then the institution decision did. Here, the institution decision doesn't either. Let's turn to your institution decision in this case. The institution decision followed your claim chart. And my problem with the institution decision is on page 21, page 19, 20, and 21 is where it goes through and tells you which claim and which particular references it is instituting on with regard to each of those claims.
Yes. Now, ground 4, which is the order instituting on appendix 177, says claims 1 through 14 and 16 through 20 of the 758 patent is likely unpatentable under section 103 over Campbell, Hirota, Saito, and Stiles.
Here's the concern that is potentially there for you. It's that when on the prior pages, the board goes through an itemization of all the dependent claims and then cites the specific record locations for supporting the limitations in those dependent claims. For the relevant ones here, 3, 16, and 20, we don't see any reference to Stiles. We see references to Saito. Then, did you file a petitioner's reply in this case?
Yes.
In your petitioner's reply, did you, for either claims 3, 16, or 20, cite to Vestile's teaching of water vapor and carbon dioxide, or in your petitioner's reply, did you cite exclusively just DeSito for those?
We addressed the arguments that AmeriChem raised in its opposition.
No, I understand, but can you answer my question? My question is, for these claims, did you cite to Stiles for teaching these limitations regarding carbon dioxide and water vapor?
No, we did not, but the board did, and also I'd point out the question is due process. They did have due process. AmeriChem, in its response, said that the combined teachings of Campbell, Arota, Sato, and Stiles fail to render the challenged claims plural obvious. So they understood that it applied across the board. Also,
so then what do we make of the itemization of all the dependent claims that are in the institution decision, where the patent board said, here, for each one of these claims, here's the portion of the record presented to us that we are using to match up against the limitations in those dependent claims. Do we dismiss that? Do we pretend it doesn't exist?
Well, in the Genzyme case, this was expressly addressed. And there, they said that the final written decision was not limited to what was pointed to in the institution decision. And that is at 825 F3rd 368 to 369.
But that's because there was further argument development in the course of the PTAB trial there. And here, when we look at the course of the PTAB trial here, as far as I know, it's all silent with respect to Stiles' relevance in terms of these particular dependent claims, 316 and 20. Okay. Is that fair to say?
Okay. Yes, but what I would like to point out, and this was not addressed in their brief, Stiles says that the generation, I'm sorry, Sato says that the most preferred regeneration gas is hydrogen, which can be diluted by nitrogen. Stiles says regeneration gas is hydrogen in nitrogen. Both carbon dioxide and water vapor can also be present. Stiles discloses the same regeneration gas as Sato, but further allows for the inclusion of carbon dioxide and water vapor. So it's not a switch and swap, not take one element out of Sato and put an element in Stiles. It is right there. And this provision in Stiles that says further includes carbon dioxide and water vapor was in our petition, in the body of our petition.
Yes, but to be fair, again, you didn't rely on that key sentence from Stiles to match up with claims 316 and 20. You were using Stiles as a basis for a motivation to combine the primary Campbell reference with Arota.
The motivation to combine was a separate sentence from Stiles, not the one that says that the regeneration gas can further include carbon dioxide and water vapor. And in fact, we laid it out and then said further includes. That sentence was included in the institution decision, and it was also included in the final written decision. So,
Here's the problem. When you look at like your petition at page 59, when you're talking about claim 17, you point to each of the references that you think contribute, Sato, Hiroto, and Stiles, and you quote from Stiles and you say why. In the institution decision, the board parrots your petition identically with regard to claim 17. And then, of course, in the Patent Office's response to all of this, when it discusses Claim 17 at page 231 and 232, they go through and explain why Stiles doesn't, in fact, disclose what they think is being disclosed. Now, the board found against them, ultimately. But they knew what they were shooting at, because your petition cited Stiles for this proposition, the institution decision cited it for that proposition, and then they addressed it. I guess my problem is you didn't cite Stiles for these other claims in your petition. Yes. The institution decision didn't particularize Stiles to those claims either, and then they didn't address them, and you didn't address them in your response, and then all of a sudden the board doesn't find for you in light of Sato. They find for you on an alternative ground. styles, which feels to me like nobody saw coming.
Well, I'd like to point you to the institution decision at APX 0168. There, the board said...
What page in the record is this?
It's appendix 168.
168?
Yes, which is page 13 of the institution decision. And yes, it reads...
This is under the header, Differences Between Subject Matter and Claim 1 in Campbell. Correct?
Yes.
The header, Differences Between Subject Matter and Claim 1 in Campbell. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, and it reads, the combined teachings of Campbell, Hirota, and Stiles failed to render the challenged claims obvious. So the board...
Wait, I'm sorry, you said 168? I'm sorry. With you.
I'm sorry, 168, I read the wrong thing in my notes. Hirota, Sato, and Stiles likely overcome any differences between Campbell and the subject matter of Claim 1 of the 758 patent. Yet, if you go to the... I'm sorry. If you go to our claim chart, we do not cite Stiles in Claim 1. No. Stiles is not cited in the claim chart for Claim 1 yet.
Isn't this boils right down to a specific arrows for specific targets issue? I mean, in this process that you're playing, you have a specific proposition you're trying to establish with a specific target. That's a target. You have a specific arrow, i.e. a prior reference that you're throwing at it. And what you're saying is that a general arrow is good enough for a specific target.
Yes, and we're
Does
saying...
Does that sound right to you?
That is what you could just say,
well, Stiles, we cited Stiles, so whatever Stiles teaches, the board, the judge, later on should be able to say, well, ooh, I found some things in Stiles that nobody argued here, and I'm going to render my decision based on that.
Yes. The response to that is this is not something that nobody pointed to. The quote appears in our petition.
But the specific target, the reason why you were using Stiles, the reason why the board ended up using Stiles, right, was not something that you had identified that you thought they should be doing.
We identified that section in general. And
in the
Genzyme case, it said that the general discussion is sufficient and that the final written decision does not have to, is not limited to the specific portions of the reference that is cited or quoted in the institution
decision.
Okay,
we are way over your time. I promised the PTO some time, so let's give them a chance. Ms. Lynch.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Wait.
May it please the board.
Well, can we just start with the notice issue?
Sure, we can start with the notice issue. So I agree that the Genzyme case, this isn't a case where the board changed references. This isn't a case where the board suddenly relied on things that it had never cited. The board cited this in its institution decision. The petitioner cited this in its petition.
Cited the patent.
This exact disclosure that the board ends up relying on. And the Genzyme case in footnote 4,
the disclosure for what purpose, for what proposition?
They did. I agree. They didn't specifically tie it the way to a limitation the way that they did in their claim chart. So it's not tied, but it is there. And AmeriChem was put on notice that these disclosures were in play.
I guess the question for us is, if you block quote passages from a prior art reference with respect to Claim 1, and then the board institutes on Claim 1, but it also institutes on a bunch of dependent claims, and then doesn't rely on those block quotes from that prior art reference that was relied on for Claim 1, should we believe that those block quoted passages for Claim 1 should also be a live issue with respect to all these dependent claims where other
portions of the record were relied upon for purposes of the institution. Let's just say that's the way we read the institution decision.
Okay. I agree that they are block quotes, but they're specific block quotes. It's a long patent.
Yeah,
the petitioner picked these out.
This is, I guess, maybe it's a hypothetical that I'm asking, right? If a passage from a reference is relied upon for grounds of unpatentability for claim one, but it's not ever pointed to or cited for dependent claim 20, then is the board allowed to use those passages from claim that are relied upon for claim one that just happen to be also useful for claim 20 in a final written decision, even though the institution decision doesn't make any reference to those block quoted passages from the reference?
We think so, Your Honor, because they are cited. The patent owner was put
on.
Wouldn't
it be more likely if it was the same element? But what you the difference, the part that's bothering me, Ms. Lynch, is quite frankly, claim one is what? Hydrogen. I'm not going to get them right. One of them, I think it's three, is carbon dioxide. One of them is water vapor. It's not the same element at all. And so you have a block quote from Stiles and in the section saying claim one, and it happens to include a discussion of both hydrogen, carbon dioxide, and water vapor. But you're only citing it, and in fact, you italicize it with regard to hydrogen, because that's the element in claim one that it was relevant to. Why would the petitioner or the patentee be on notice that that reference is also being instituted with regard to claims three's very separate element of carbon dioxide? If I'm getting them wrong, correct me. The facts are not crystal clear in my head, but I think it's carbon dioxide. So why would the patentee be on notice that this thing you cited, which happens to also say carbon dioxide in it, I don't have a dispute over that, is nonetheless what you're importing into the claim three analysis? It was the same element. You know how like the same element appears in lots of claims, worded ever so slightly differently sometimes, but it's the same element. This isn't the same element. It's a different element.
Because the petitioner picked this out, it clearly discloses it. AmeriChem doesn't dispute that it doesn't disclose this. So they pick out this block quote, they put it in there. Maybe it does teach multiple limitations. They were on notice that Volkswagen had picked out this block quote. They thought it was relevant. The board put it in
its
institution
decision. Even
though
Volkswagen only said it was relevant with regard to claim one, because the entire analysis is under the header of claim one. So even though in the petition it's only articulated as relevant to claim one, we should nonetheless assume, because it happens to also read on dependent limitations, that it's nonetheless relevant there.
The heading is for all of the claims. I don't know why you're saying it's just claim one. Maybe I'm missing something. But the section of the petition that it's in begins at 114, and it's for all of the claims.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're talking about the
I'm talking about the text where they put these block quotes in the petition. And we agree with you that they don't put this in their claim charts, but it is in the text where they're discussing the disclosures of these of Hirota, Sato, and Stiles.
Even though for some of the claims they expressly put Stiles in and for others they don't, nonetheless, I should assume it's actually relevant to all the claims?
Well, it's in their general discussion. Like I said, it's what they selected to talk about. They have a limited amount of space. This is what they selected to tell the board about. The board thought it was important enough to put it in its institution decision. Well, AmeriChem doesn't dispute that it teaches it.
I don't know. What do you think would be a good rule for patentees in general when confronted in IPRs? There's a general discussion of some references at the front, but then there's a claim chart. It goes claim by claim, element by element, identifies these specific, especially when you're talking obviousness. Mrs. Lynch, you know, there can be 10 references. You know, and sometimes there's a general statement. Various combinations of these 10 references render all of the claims obvious. Various combinations. I mean, you know, and then a patentee gets a claim chart. They got a claim chart from the petition, and they got a claim chart from the board. And neither of those claim charts use Stiles at all with regard to specific claims. And then, you know, if the patentee had recognized what you're saying, maybe they should have recognized, you would think you would then see them fighting Stiles in the petitioner's response after institution, which they don't do. And if the petitioner did intend to use Stiles like you thought, you would think you would see them mentioning Stiles in the briefing after the institution decision. None of them do, except with regard to Claim 17, which is the only claim chart it appears in. So forget about this case. As a rule of law, what puts a patentee on notice as to what the board has instituted on? Do we want to say a generalized statement with some general discussion at the outset or at the end is enough when there are claim charts present that go item by item like this? Is that a burden we want to introduce, given that, as you recognize, the limited page numbering, the speed with which this process moves forward, and all of that? I'm not saying these are good claims. They might not be. But from a notice standpoint, what should the patentee have done?
Can I answer them? That's my time.
Yeah, don't worry about the time. Okay. You're being very helpful to the court.
I feel like the Genzyme case kind of answered that.
But doesn't NuVasive sort of...
But NuVasive was the case, right, where something new came up in the reply and the party tried to ask the board if they could put in rebuttal evidence and the board said no, right? So that's what that was about.
Suppose I don't think Genzyme answers this. Suppose I don't think that. You tell me from a policy standpoint, what makes good policy here?
So obviously there has to be notice. I think notice can be given in different ways. It doesn't have to be through a claim chart. Claim charts aren't even required.
They're not required, but when they're given, don't they focus everybody on what the understanding, especially when there's a large number of references and a limited number of pages, doesn't that sort of almost trump everything else in terms of focusing everybody on which references are relevant to which claims?
The board didn't think it trumped everything else here because Volkswagen picked out this disclosure and it clearly teaches it. So I think you have to look at everything in the petition. And, you know, Genzyme, I know maybe you don't think Genzyme is particularly on point, but Genzyme talks about when something is in play. And I think by quoting those disclosures, they were in play.
And I know you wanted to and were prepared to, and I'd actually like to hear you, if you don't mind staying a little longer, I would like to hear your thoughts about the first issue that we discussed, which is the issue of corroboration.
Right. So it's our position that, you know, AmeriChem did the bare, put in a naked assertion. All they did was...
What's the agency's articulation of the rule?
The agency's articulation of the rule and the MPEP.
Well, you came prepared today to give us a rule. What's the rule?
The rule is something more. And you can see that from the board. The board didn't necessarily say you have to have a document or you have to have a story. You can see the board is talking about there has to be something more than this naked assertion. Basically, all they did was take the quotes from Volkswagen's petition and say, me and Guth solely invented this, and Guth is dead. So they didn't give any story, any explanation. They didn't attach any documents. And I think in Woodland Trust, the court says it's a rare case when there wouldn't be any documents. They're the owner of the Campbell 558. It's hard to believe that they didn't have any.
Do you agree with the distinction argued for by Mr. Meyer that Katz is different because there wasn't something more? There might have been a story, but we can all tell a good story. If a story is still in a declaration, it's still just a story. You know, so do you agree with him that stories are okay when it's a publication that you're delineating as between, but definitely not for patents? Is that the line that you would think is right to draw?
Not necessarily. I think Katz says definitely the story was enough for a publication. We do think, based on the MPEP, that when something is claimed, there has to be a higher standard. And that's why the MPEP says when you're relying on claim subject matter, you have to talk about what those other inventors did. So we do agree that when the reference is a patent, that there is, and it's claimed, that there is a higher standard. But, you know, the board didn't say what you necessarily... We're not arguing for a bright-line test.
So is your view, if it was disclosed in the patent but wasn't part of what was claimed, what they did here would have been sufficient?
Not necessarily. I wouldn't say that, but at
least... Isn't that what the MPEP pretty much concludes?
Well, the MPEP has provisions about disclosed, not claimed.
Which version of the MPEP, if the MPEP were applicable and we were required to give it meaning in this decision, which version would we apply?
We think the current version applies because they're putting in the declaration now. And the MPEP clearly says that if it is...
This declaration would fail under the current
It would
version.
Fail. It also fails under the earlier MPEP provisions as well, because all of those
your
are...
Your position is that the current version applies.
That is...
Okay. Secondly, in terms of the burdens of going forward production as well as the burden of persuasion, the burden of persuasion here is on the challenger throughout, correct?
Correct.
And the in terms of this particular question of by another, the fact that the patent that they're trying to assert was a joint patent, the challenger met its burden to shift the burden of production over to the patentee, correct? Everybody agrees with that?
Correct.
Right. The effect of the board's decision and of what you're asking us here to do is to give zero weight to the inventor's affidavit.
That it didn't
zero
meet their,
weights. It is not evidence anymore. It's gone.
It didn't meet their burden of production.
It's
correct.
No, it doesn't qualify as evidence. If it qualifies as evidence in any way, shape, or form, right?
It would have to raise a material fact. Then, that's the standard.
Well, raise a material issue of fact.
Right.
And so you're saying unexplained, a bare assertion can't meet that test. I'm just looking for what that rule of law has to be, because we're seeing this in a burden shifting. In this particular setting, we know that the ultimate burden of persuasion never moves off the challenger.
Correct.
But as it turns out here, as a result of the operation of the burden of production, the burden of persuasion has shifted to the patentee, and he lost.
Well, he didn't satisfy his burden of production.
But in dynamic drinkware, wasn't there an amount of evidence put forward by the patentee to get the ball moved back in the other direction?
Correct. So it shifted back in dynamic drinkware here. It never shifted off the patent owner because their declaration was deficient.
Okay, so if we were to adopt your rule, why wouldn't the correct result be, well, from your perspective, there's nothing going for the patentee with his declaration, so the game is over.
Correct, he was not able to shift the burden back, the burden of production back.
What is the origin for, I guess, the PTO's position that when something is disclosed but not claimed in a patent, there's some kind of lesser requirement? I don't even know how to begin to articulate it, but there's some lesser requirement, and then when it's disclosed and claimed, then there's something more required than the situation where it's disclosed but not claimed in a patent.
Because, you know, if you look at the reference patent, the inventor signed an oath saying that they contributed at least some subject matter to at least some of the claims. And the idea is if someone is going to come in years later and try and rebut that and say, well, I'm the one who claimed claim one, that they need to make more of a showing, because there's already oaths on file saying that these four people in this case claimed something. So they have to make a showing under the MPEP to show what those other people did as well.
And what's your best authority that you have for making this distinction, whether it's a case or something else, precedent?
I think the MPEP just relies on, I don't think it relies on a specific case to say that. I mean, I think they discussed Abound, but I don't think that's exactly what happened in Abound. And can I just point out one sentence in Abound, and then I realize I'm so over
sure,
my time.
Go for it.
But this paragraph that you talked about in Fascis, which is the...
Yes, cited in Dipollon.
Yes, so the last sentence says, in contrast, appellant's declaration here states that he originally conceived the basic equalizer honeycomb section disclosed in the 678 patent and in drawing 73315. So I would say that they were, in their opinion, relying on that drawing. And the concurrence talks about the drawing as well. It talks about other facts supported by exhibits, which justify the conclusion.
Yeah, but the majority certainly didn't. I didn't see them as relying on it, but thank you for pointing that sentence out to me.
If the court has no further questions.
Thank you. Mr. Bradford, we're going to give you your 6 minutes of rebuttal time, and we're going to hope we can keep it to that, but they went so far over that if you feel like you really need to stand here longer,
okay,
at some point
you.
I'll make you sit.
Thank you, Arnie. I'll do whatever you want me to do.
All right, well, see you later.
Hold on a second. Starting with the Campbell declaration, the Campbell-Devon issue, we've discussed this a lot. But I think Katz is important. You know, there's this discussion of this story, but because there are several co-inventors. But Katz explains why they wanted to see this story. They say, what we have in this case is ambiguity created by the printed publication. The article does not tell us anything about specific inventorship. So they wanted this declaration to explain an ambiguity. I think the CCPA wasn't comfortable with, well, what does it mean to be an author? The same type of ambiguity clarification is not required in Devon. This wasn't decided because they showed a story. Katz wasn't decided this way. It's because they explained an ambiguity. But in Devon, they didn't have to explain the same ambiguity because there is evidence that they are inventors.
I guess when I think about Katz, I'm wondering if you really have two separate hurdles you have to deal with, unlike Devon. Devon, the inventor was trying to swear away from passages of a patent.
Exactly.
Patent. Katz was about trying to swear away relevant passages of an article. And so I saw our opinion, or CCPA's opinion, talk about how when it comes to an article, we shouldn't be so quick to presume that co-authors are really inventors of all that is contained in an article. And an article is just a different situation. And who you designate and label and identify as an author is not the same exercise that one goes through in identifying and labeling someone as a co-inventor for a patent. And so I guess what I'm wondering is maybe there is something to it, what the agency is getting at, that perhaps in a Katz-like situation, the agency or the law shouldn't require as something as stringent in terms of trying to swear away the passages of an article compared to when someone is trying to swear away passages of a legal document like a patent.
I think it's actually the opposite. If Katz was trying to swear behind another patent, I believe they didn't need this extra explanation. I don't think there's any. Devon actually states very explicitly that the 678 patent is silent with respect to who invented the honeycomb exception itself, and we do not presume that it is the invention of appellant and Knoll jointly or either of them. So there's no presumption that they both invented everything. And the board's not saying there's some presumption to overcome here, or the CCPA. What they're saying is there is no presumption. We just understand he's an inventor. That's the presumption. And so he's explaining. He's just telling us what's in line with that prior explanation. I'm an inventor, and I'll tell you what I invented. And there's no contradiction to that. I think that should surely be enough, especially just to raise a material question of fact. I mean, cases all the time are found to have material questions of fact based on testimony alone. But I don't believe, and the drawing there is not corroboration. It was put in to show evidence, I believe, of reduction to practice. But there was a statement, I believe, in the prior discussion that Devon explained that he developed this drawing, but he doesn't ever say that. He doesn't say he developed this drawing. He's putting it in and says...
Well, but what you think it has to be enough to raise a material question of fact. What's the difference between that and the PTO saying this declaration by an interested party with no corroboration, as a matter of fact, simply doesn't convince us?
It's almost like you want everything. It's almost like this has to be an everything or nothing conclusion. Could the PTO do that? Could the PTO say, based on this record and nothing else, that, you know what, this declaration, while it is evidence, and we consider it to be evidence, it just doesn't convince us. It's an interested party many years after the fact, claiming what he invented, his co-inventor's dead, so there's nobody to challenge him. We consider it to be not enough. Could they have made that fact finding?
Well, the factors they decided upon, I think they could have made it, but it'd been wrong. But, I'm sorry that came across wrong. I don't think that would be correct because it's based on an incorrect set of factors. The factors they're relying on are from this Woodland and Sant line of cases. And there was a presumption they had to overcome.
No. But just to put a finer point on the question from the court, it's that you were saying that this declaration should be considered something that's enough to create a triable issue or a fact or something like
correct.
That. And really, in the end, we're at the end game when the board issues its final written decision. And it's got to reach a result right there, make a final choice. And it could say a couple of different things under this scenario. One is, this evidence did not shift the burden because it's not really evidence of anything. Or to the extent that it's evidence, it's of such low quality, it's not enough to shift the burden back. The alternative is to say, we take into account your evidence of this declaration, and then we go back and look at the prima facie case that this is good prior art. And in the end, when we look at all the circumstances here, time has passed, everything else, we make a finding on this record that it's good prior art against these claims. So it kind of takes away the so-called burden of production shifting framework and just reaches a final conclusion based on everything that everybody's presented in the case on whether or not this reference should be considered a 102E reference.
Well, Your Honor, the way the IPAR proceeding works, after they make their prima facie case, then we have a chance to present our response, and then they have a chance to put in a reply. So they have a chance to try to contradict this, and
but
that's
maybe
not.
Maybe they don't need to. Maybe the evidence is of such a weak nature that it doesn't need to be contradicted because the prima facie case alone is enough, and that this doesn't overcome it.
Well, but and I understand the Patent Office prior decisions maybe not be binding in view of DeBond and Cass, but there's several of these cases that explain an unequivocal declaration may not be enough, but it is if it's uncontradicted. And that's what they say. And I think it's reasonable for us for a patent owner to follow that guidance that's repeated in the NPEP, that's repeated in several places. And it's in my opinion in line with Katz having an unequivocal declaration. It doesn't state that DeBond doesn't state there's documentary corroboration that's needed. And the board said there is no documentary corroboration. And the board said, well, this isn't an interested inventor. Well, Katz and DeBond are interested inventors. I mean, all of these cases are interested inventors. I mean, why else would they be put forward?
Okay, well, we're well over our time. Do you have a final thought, or are we good to go?
Well, Your Honor, briefly, I think you're correct on the styles issue. It's in.
I don't think we need to go down that road right now. I think we're good. We have your arguments in your briefs, and I think we're good. We thank both counsel or all counsel for their participation in the oral argument. It was very helpful to the court. The case is taken under submission.
Thank you.
Our final case for today is 2016-2370.